punk and the schooner. No one is punk. Can the schooner.
Goodness gracious, show number 44 of Noise Punk and Das Crooner. I am Das Crooner. Gene, who are you?
Yo, I'm Noise Punk. Yo, what's up? Noise Punk on the house with Das Crooner. Show number 44, and we got a very special
guest.
Whose name is?
David Winkler.
Composer. We don't know what else he does. We know he's a composer.
That's enough, isn't it? I mean, being a composer, how much more do you
sometimes
have to
we
be?
Say, like, composer, guitarist, pianist, but we're going to find us hidden talents to show you all.
I hope so.
Stick to. David, how are you?
How are you?
How are you? And how are you?
I'm fine. How about Gene?
I'm pretty good. I got crabs because of Charles. Wait a minute.
And this is funny because
I'm supposed to talk about that. I know that.
All right, sorry. I'll edit that later. No, I won't.
No, he won't. He doesn't edit anything. Yeah. Hello.
Is that time for Charles to ask his favorite question?
Well, not really my favorite.
What's in Charles'
head? I'm interested in this. Let's hear it.
Not really my favorite. It's what I normally ask at the beginning of every program. What got you started?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I mean, this goes back to, like, childhood. I was your typical sort of, introvert, hideaway, non-social person. And I discovered music. There was a little bit of floating around in the family. I got into, playing instruments. And then as a teenager, at 13, 14, I started composing music. That was the place for me.
Were you one of those nerds with glasses in your own little room trying to come up with all these unique sounds that you didn't want anyone else to hear about?
Not about you.
Right. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, it's absolutely totally correct, except I didn't wear glasses.
Okay. All right. There you go. But you didn't look the part, but you certainly acted the part.
I totally acted the part. And actually, I really got into it when I was in high school. And I don't know why I was walking around the halls of one of the colleges in Southern California, and I noticed a filmmaker wanted someone to write a film score. I thought this could be cool. So I just pulled the sheet down. I called that guy up. 2 months later, after he'd finished editing, he called me up. I wound up doing a film score that actually did quite well. I was like 17 years old, and that really got me into it because he allowed me to orchestrate, to record, and he supported a small orchestral recording, and that really got my feet wet into what's possible.
Is that film that's available commercially, or was it a studio?
You're going to have to go way, 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 way deep beneath the earth to find it. It was actually an underground film called The Aquarium, which won several awards. It won awards in the Festival of Algiers, and it took a medal in the Festival of the Americas in Houston. And as a matter of fact, one of the scenes I wrote, amazing, I can still remember this, one of the scenes I wrote actually got an award. So that gave me some confidence. And then I shipped myself off to Italy after that to study in the conservatory in Florence and, really got serious at that point.
When you wrote this film score, was it unusual to apply your musical ideas to a film? And as you know, in film, the score is secondary in a film and it mainly aids what's going on visually. Was that an interesting thing for you to go through? Or?
Well, as a kid, I was 17 years old. It turned out to be the perfect project because it was a silent film.
Silent film.
That's even bigger.
I wish Charles' music was that.
Yeah, very funny.
Silent music.
John Cage beat me to that, remember?
Okay, sorry.
4.33, powerful piece. Does he get royalties? But anyway, on that happy note, we'd like to hear some of your stuff. What would you like us to hear, first of all?
Because your introduction is so earthy and close to my heart, I figure we might as well play the second movement of this Elements Concerti Violin Concerto, which is called Earth. Mm-hmm. So on the CD, I think it'd be cut number 5. And it's about 6 minutes long. And it tends to be I have a 16-year-old daughter. She likes this movement. And most of her, teenage friends like it, the ones that are into kind of metal. This is about the closest thing I have to sort of Eastern European heavy orchestrated, metal in style. But it is part of a concerto, for a violin and string orchestra, you know, you have Vivaldi at the beginning of your show,
yep.
sort of. And the thing is that this is really, this piece was written as an answer to Vivaldi Four Seasons. It really came about as a joke because I was working with a French chamber orchestra, and one year I was bothering them, why don't you play some of my music? And they told me, the Orchestra de Chambre Francaise told me that no one plays anything but Vivaldi in Paris, France. That was several years ago, and it was absolutely true. So I wrote a piece that sort of paralleled Vivaldi Four Seasons. So, but instead of calling them seasons, I call them the elements.
Okay. So that's good. This is the second movement from the Elements Concerto, written in written in 2005. This is actually featured on a recent Naxos recording. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Featuring the violinist Anna Rabinova
yes.
and the Orchestra de Chambre Francaise
yes.
with Ivan Melemans.
Melemans, correct.
Melemans. I got most of that right. Here on Music of David Winkler.
Charles, you're an excellent reader. You're an excellent reader.
I thank you. First time you said that to me ever in the 4 years of our program. Here on Noise Punk and Das Crooner. Thank you. distinctive, ambiguous note at the end. That was the movement from the Elements Concerti, written by our guest David Winkler. That was the Earth Movement, the second movement, featuring violinist Anna Rabinova, along with the Orchestre de Chambre Francais. Ivan Melmans was the conductor here on Noise Punk and Das Kruner.
Yeah!
Rockin'.
Yeah.
Needless to say, I assume it was a great feeling that the Noxus people got involved in this one.
Absolutely. And, you know, for any composer to get, first of all, you know, imprinted by a well-known label, but also the distribution is extremely good. And it's like a sort of an imprimatur that, you know, your music has a certain, how should we say, validity or acceptance, and people do notice it.
Absolutely. I mean, in recent years, I mean, when Noxus started out maybe, what, 10, 15 years ago, they obviously, these cheap recordings, it can't be that good. It turned out that their technology eventually evolved, and thus their popularity in the fact that they were cheap slowly evolved.
Right. Well, that also combined with the fact that they have a commitment to, you know, living American composers. They have a whole sort of sub-label devoted to those people.
The American Classics, right?
Exactly.
Which is what this is part of.
Right, it is. And I think that from a composer's standpoint, it makes you feel like you're potentially part of a, you know, continuum, and that it's sort of like having a publisher sort of in the old world sense.
Yes. How does it feel to be one who's gets considered a classic on, even though you're still with us?
Well, you know, classical is like one of my favorite words, because I don't really think we ever know what it actually means. And besides, you know, the you know, beauty is in the ear of the beholder. So, you know, something which is classical for one person is, you know, maybe very unclassical for another. I think, you know, it implies that at least a certain number of people can hear something and get something out of it.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's true. But I think it's true that people are important, but as a collective. And I think the only real judge is time.
Right.
So it's the time that people keep thinking that something is classic. So, you know, I mean, and of course it doesn't apply to everything, because a lot of things that might have been classic got lost in time due to whatever. Mm. But I think most of the things that we think is classic today, and even things that are like 30 years old, like Led Zeppelin records, they're classic. You know, even though the time hasn't really, you know, they're not as classic as Bach or something, you know, 300 years old. But yeah, still, they're classic. We're pretty sure that they're going to last. I mean, people will like them. I don't know. So that's my take on the classic word.
Yeah.
I mean, my 16-year-old daughter, she's certain that there are certain things she likes are going to be, you know, classics. I mean, you know, there are X number of bands that she likes. And to her, those things have been classical, a classic in the last 2, 3, 4 consecutive years. So
yeah, but I mean, and you may agree or disagree with her, but and I might agree or disagree with you and her, whatever. But in the end, it's time that we'll decide.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So, and I mean, and I put myself, like, kind of, when I have this conversation with you guys, it's fine, but with non-musicians, I'm like, just think about it like you're talking to a doctor. This is what I do all day long. I think about this. You know, what is good music? What is going to be great art? You know, I think through it about my music, but, of course, about other music. So when you're talking, I mean, your tastes are your tastes, and my tastes are my tastes, and we're not going to discuss the taste. It's about knowledge.
No, but I got to share something with you. We haven't got a couple minutes for this, right?
Yeah, go on.
Okay. There's just something which I've been noticing the past bunch of years, and I think that there's a parallel in the world of music. But right now I'm talking about the visual world. Mm-hmm. I've noticed that stuff which was photographed in the 40s and 50s, whether it's, you know, movies or even early TV from the Golden Age, as we proceed farther in time, that stuff gets grainier and grainier and loses its luster. Even if they try to remaster it and redigitize it and all that stuff, its quality tends to evaporate as time goes on. And I've just seen the same thing with certain strands of music. Now, you know, I'm not going to go around saying what I think that's happening to, because that's not really my job. I'm not a cultural historian or music critic, but I know what's happening. And it really fascinates me, because I can see stuff from various eras gradually, you know, begin to evaporate. So
you mean the actual music or the...
Well, the cogency, the substance of the music is beginning to wear.
Right.
And I think it's... But sort of getting back to what you were saying, I think it's easier to notice that. I mean, if you're really into it. And I'm maybe not from quite the same standpoint as you, but I'm thinking about it all the time.
Right.
And I think what enables you to arrive at a viewpoint as to what you know, where the substance is, where the beef is, so to speak, right, is if you have, you know, a really, you know, a lengthy, right, at least back to the Baroque era, maybe farther back.
Even for, yeah, well, the more, it's knowledge, man. You know, you have an overview. I'm looking at music from the top of a, you know, skyscraper where somebody's talking, and they're like, looking into a book, you know, 100 yeah. feet below, and that's all they could see. They don't know what came before. They might a little bit, whatever. Right. But I'm seeing it as a bigger picture. Just because, sure. not because I'm so fucking smart, but because this is all I do.
I thought you were fucking smart. What are you talking about? Isn't that why I'm here?
Debatable.
This is all that I do, you know?
Thank you for putting in your two cents.
but that also, you know, that type of thing that you're talking about, the degradation in a certain type of music as it goes on and on, happened in everything. Happened in Baroque music, in classical music. There was a zillion composers during Bach and Mozart times that we forgot about. And sometimes these guys, they resurrect them, like, oh, some, and it's crap.
Right.
It's the reason we forgot about them. Time yeah. really did tell that this is not standing the test of time. This is not great.
Right. Well, you know, composers have a tendency to get swallowed up yeah. by what turns out to be, you know, the most forceful, the strongest architecture of the period.
Right.
They sometimes, if you haven't studied the work of a particular composer who's important, you wind up repeating him. And that winds up catching up with you later on. Yeah. So they're all sort of like these little mystery games that I think artists have to be somehow, you know, hook into, whether it's visual art or, you know, photography or painting or sculpture or poetry, what it is, having an understanding of the context in which you're working and really being pretty merciless with yourself as to, you know, what your real influences are and where your weaknesses are. And weaknesses tend to be connected to the thing you don't study. And it's sort of a conundrum, but you got to work at it.
Speaking of pieces that we would like to become...
Pretty intellectual conversation.
Yes.
For Noise Punk and Daskuna.
Yeah, yeah. You believe it or not.
I can turn on the other side if you want. I mean, no problem.
I'm going to have to go back, edit, and put a couple of fucks in it.
I was just talking to a guy today who I ran into just quite by accident. He turns out to have lived... I grew up in L.A., and he was in L.A. the same time. And this is like a total stranger. And it turns out we went to high schools that were a few months apart. He turned out to be a producer in, how should we say, the rock and roll and metal with the A&R Records and A&M, whatever it was, and a bunch of other labels. And I went on to do classical. But the thing is, we crossed paths and didn't even know it until, like, you know, 30 years later here. We hook up in New York. He moved to New York. But anyway, we shared a bunch of almost shared memories of, you know, being in the same place at the same time. Anyway, it was just, you know, kind of a fascinating piece of synchronicity.
So different and yet so the same.
Sorry.
Which remind, well, so speaking of wine, speaking
Turtle,
of,
stop drowning.
You know,
sorry.
Speaking of wanting to make pieces last through periods of time, you have a piano concerto that's also featured on this Naxos record. Talk about this.
You are a good reader.
Comes and goes.
Well, the piano concerto was commissioned by the Symphonie Un Cuyo of Mendoza, Argentina. A good friend of mine, David Hendel, is the music director down there and conducts throughout South America, actually. And we planned to do this for a while, and he managed to get the pianist Alexander Panizza to be available to do this. So I wrote this work. We went down there, and, you know, unlike what you can do in the U.S., down there we spent a whole week recording. You know, it was the first time this orchestra had ever done a commercial recording. So it was really a wonderful experience for me, and the piece is designed to be programmed on the kind of concerts where, you know, major 19th to 20th century piano concertos would be featured. That's what the purpose of the work is, to sort of represent a slightly newer look, a newer version of the, you know, classical so-called, you know, future romantic format, in which I've been working to a degree, people tell me. Mm-hmm. And it's somewhat virtuosic for the pianist, but the main thing is that it has a very, very tall orchestral kind of, you know, fabric. And and stylistically, even though it sounds like a concerto for piano and orchestra in the usual thematic sense, their harmonic vocabulary is completely different. It's part of this modal world that I've been developing for about 15 years now, and people tend to be a little put off by it because it tends to be somewhat grand. But actually, I think that's a good thing. And the recording was really wonderful to do, and the pianist is fantastic, and it actually got a good review somewhere. So I was relatively pleased with it. But I'll say one thing for any composers out there for your first recording project, don't do a piano concerto, because it was such an immense undertaking from a recording standpoint, and I was really not I was not equipped to expect all of the vastness and the breadth and thickness of the event as it unfolded. I mean, it was fine to do, but you know, you're probably better off doing a few chamber music works on a commercial recording basis, maybe some chamber orchestra, then work your way up to this. I just jumped right in. This is my first recorded work on a commercial basis, and it was an exciting process.
All right, so this is the first movement. Yeah. Interesting title, Maestoso e Cantabile.
Right.
Like a big, big fat bear that can sing.
That's you.
You know it. That's right. That's me. Our guest, David Winkler, telling it straight here on Noise Punk and Das Crooner.
Thank you.
Holy crap, that was good.
Why, thank you.
Yeah, all right. That was the first... Impeccable timing, Gene. That was the first movement of the Piano Concerto by our guest David Winkler, written in 2006. That was the pianist Alexander Panizza.
Excellent.
Along with the Orquesta Sinfonica della Universidad de Cuyo.
Kudos for you.
Here with with conductor David Handel. No relation to George Frederick, I assume not. But anyway.
Distant at best. Well, there's no umlaut, so I know it can't be.
That's right. That's right. Of course not. Yeah. While we were listening there, we were talking about the issue of symphonic form and stuff. You yourself have written three symphonies, the third of which is going to be performed soon by the Alabama Symphony, is it?
Correct.
Yeah. A lot of you know, Gene and I have on our show with various guests have talked about the issue of symphonic form, how in recent years a lot of composers have completely ignored it. And I happen to agree generally with Gene that a lot of composers have ignored it, you know, in terms of sonata, allegro, certain things. Some people think that a symphony is simply a large work for symphony orchestra.
What it's come to be, and people use the word symphony. To name a piece of music.
Yeah.
And then when you hear the piece, it doesn't really have anything to do with symphony, which I guess is okay. But the word itself has been used. It's kind of like, you know, so many times that it has certain connotations.
But do you think of form when you write, when you've written along this concerto, the three symphonies? How prominent a thought is that when you're writing?
Well, I think that the form generally grows out of the thematic material. I mean, it's possible to write something which is symphonic, that is to say a large-scale orchestral work of some length, though it isn't necessarily a symphony. It's a really good question. It sort of gets back to what we were talking about historically, the context. I mean, if you write a piece which is a symphony, it implies that it either, you know, is a multi-movement work coming out of one aspect of the tradition, or at least that even if it's a one-movement piece, that it has a sectionalization to it, which... suggests certain kinds of new thematic contrasts and development. It's sort of like the beauty is in the ear of the beholder. I mean, I think it's possible to write, you know, an orchestral work of indeterminate length, which you could call a symphony, even though it could be, completely continuously new at all times and not have any of the kind of architectural references and frameworks that we associate with the traditional symphonic works.
Question is why?
Why what?
Why name it symphony?
Oh, well, that's a good question. For example, the first symphony, let's get completely egotistical here. We'll talk about me.
Yeah. You're the guest after all. Duh.
The first symphony, my first symphony, was a one-movement piece. Mm-hmm. However, it was constructed along the lines of sonata form, so-called sonata allegro, but I sort of fused the movements together, encapsulated them into, you know, a single... movement that could be, I think, understood as one thing, but also clearly containing, you know, several, you know, three distinct, you know, parts with contrasting and also, you know, thematic ideas which, you know, came back for additional development at the end. In that sense, I think of the piece as certainly symphonic, but, you know, you can't really compare it to major symphonic works of the, you know, the mid-19th century. When I think of a symphony, I think of, you know, either the Beethoven group or, you know, Brahms' first symphony or, you know, some of the Bruckner or even the, you know, the Mahler first, which is, you know, a five-movement work which is internally, you know, referential. There is some flexibility about that.
But the thing is, well, everything you said about the symphonies, obviously, when you're writing it, you're thinking about, since you're already using sonata allegro form, you're using, you know, even if the movements are fused together, but you're consciously understand that it's a symphony and it has to have like these movements that you're just putting them together. So you're actually, the word symphony implies something when you're writing it to you. I feel a lot of times people are just writing orchestral music and say, you know, it's four movements and they say symphony.
I agree.
After Berlioz's Sinfonia, who kind of made fun of all that and said, you know what, there is no more thing. You know, here's the symphony. I'm going to chop it up and this is not a symphony. I'm calling it symphony as almost a joke.
You know,
after that, it's almost, I can't write a, you know, I have many orchestral works and some of them meant movements, but I will never call them symphony because I'm not thinking of that. I'm coming from the orchestral tradition. I study all this, you know, absolutely, but I'm definitely not thinking on that scale and using those forms. If I ever do, I will call it a symphony. Yeah.
Well, I think that hits it right on the head. I mean, if you're going to call a work a symphony, the implication is, and particularly in this field of classical music, which is, you know, a literature, generally speaking, everything or most everything is, you know, written down for the purpose of being, you know, comparable to you know, the tradition which we've inherited. If you're going to call a piece a symphony, then I think what you're saying is that there are elements to it, maybe many elements to the work, right, which are part of, or would you want to be heard in the context of the continuum of those other works which have been called symphony. Otherwise, there are plenty of other, there are zillions of other pieces by, you know, Debussy, Ravel, Richard Strauss, who weren't called symphonies, right, but yet are written for a symphony orchestra and have a symphonic feel if you just listen to them isolated.
But well, let me put my two cents in here. I find those, thank you, Gene.
Sound of two cents?
Yes. Ravel, you mentioned, you know, Ravel and Strauss, that is more specifically programmatic music, in which the music is associated with a certain subject matter. What one of the attractions to the term symphony is that it's abstract.
But
I know there's more. I agree with
Beethoven and Mahler.
I know. I think symphonic. I agree generally with Gene that you are at least morally obligated to apply a more. Well, I mean, there's no. You can do whatever you want. You call it. You can write anything and call it a symphony. But you are morally required to apply certain symphonic form that has been used over the last few centuries. I think the symphonic form is mainly a template for which you can take your general ideas and put them together like an architect in a building.
Well, you know, it's really the composer's choice. I think that either specifically or in general, the creative artist, in this case the composer specifically, is really deciding how he or she...
What the hell?
My email, sorry.
You have a harpsichord running around here out of control?
No, that wasn't harpsichord.
Sitar.
That was a sitar thing.
A real sitar.
I apologize.
Yeah, I just don't at all. You were saying...
I was saying that it's really the composer who decides ultimately the context in which their work is going to be heard. And, you know, you in the back of your mind, I think that you imagine the where the premiere is taking place, what kind of orchestra is taking place, what kind of audience is going to be there, even the hall or the acoustics. You're in the audience yourself. So you have an idea about how the piece is supposed to be heard. And if you're thinking of your work as, you know, something that's going to be heard in the context of, you know, the symphonic repertoire of symphonies, then that's really you're applying to yourself the responsibility of doing something that belongs on that stage with those other works.
There you
right,
go.
Because I mean, it's basically a name, right? It's the first thing you hear, the first thing you see when you see the symphony. There are certain expectations, and if those expectations are not met by a little bit of a letdown, right? Or not even a letdown, or I don't know. Maybe I don't even know if people care, but I think it's you know. I like titles. Why not?
You know, I'll tell you something. Recently, I've written operatically several symphonies, a number of concertos now, and I think of a symphony as kind of like the equivalent of a novel. Mm-hmm. And if you're calling a book a novel or an orchestral work a symphony, what you're doing is you're saying that there's something very, very significant about the work that you've just completed. This particular project has something in it. Not just one-dimensional. That a symphony implies that there's a multiple range and tapestry, so to speak, of, you know, thematic ideas that associate with one another over, you know, a significant period of time. So you're saying that there's depth to what you're doing, and it's not like, you know, a one-off isolated miniature project. It's something which is going to have a lot of resonance over time. So I think
like I like that answer. Actually, that's the best answer I think I've ever heard from anybody
that we had on our show.
Yes,
but, still having
for me. But the only problem with that answer is it diminishes some of my other pieces that might be just as long and just as deep, as far as I'm concerned, but that are called, you know, souls or whatever. You know,
well,
like
I didn't say that the other pieces couldn't have that quality.
Yeah.
Only.
But
if you do call something a symphony, I think you're saying something that the piece is supposed to be heard in a certain way.
Yeah. Speaking of hearing pieces in a certain way, let's go through another level in terms of your music. You have a chamber work here.
Well, what it is it's a double concerto for piano, violin soloists with a string orchestra, similar to the Mendelssohn double, which has been played a zillion times this last year and a half.
Yes,
for obvious reasons, and I thought I'd write the piece for that instrumentation, partly for that reason, because the performers I was working with were also doing the Mendelssohn double a lot, but also because it's a work which gives opportunity to two of the soloists that I do a lot of work with in general. Right. The pianist in this is Tatiana Goncharova. The violinist is Dmitry Berlinsky.
Old friend of mine as well.
That's yeah.
Wow.
We were best friends back in freshman year.
Aye, aye, aye.
Me and Tatiana were hanging out all
It's a small world.
After all.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah,
I really needed that. Thank you. And the chamber orchestra in this case is from the Long Island Mozart Festival, which is a festival that I produce. And the conductor is Daniel Boyko, who just became the assistant conductor for the New York Philharmonic. So I had a really good cast to work with here. And it was the first time I'd written a work, a concerto type work for piano and violin as soloists. And it was also a piece that was commissioned by Old Westbury Gardens to celebrate their commitment to ecology and the environment. And so for that reason, the piece is called Concerto Green. And the first movement, which is what we're going to hear, is supposed to be, you know, evocative of aspects of the environment. And I think that go ahead.
No, go ahead. You were saying. I was just
that the title that I picked, which is, you know, Lakes and Rivers and Streams, is supposed to evoke as if you were in a forest near, you know, rivers, lakes, and streams. And this is what you might be, you know, thinking in your mind if you were, you know, in a particularly, you know, pensive or you know, possibly, thoughtful mood.
He says it's supposed to evoke that. Let's find out if he was successful at this endeavor. What are you doing, Gene?
Looking for nature sounds.
That's nature in Vietnam. But anyway.
There he goes. Nature sounds.
Yes. This is the first movement of Concerto Green by our guest David Winkler here on Noise Punk and Das Crooner.
With two friends of mine, Dmitry Berlinski and Tatiana Goncharova.
They're great.
Out of control.
They're absolutely great.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes, it ends in A major. At the very end there was a conflict between the two minor and major keys. That is my brain talking. Yes, I admit that. That music of David Winkler, that was the first movement of his Concerto Green featuring, would you give us the list of the players again, please?
Violinist is Dmitry Berlinsky, pianist Tatiana Goncharova, conductor is Daniel Boyko, now the New York Philharmonic, and the orchestra...
Assistant conductor of the...
Assistant conductor of the New York Philharmonic, and the ensemble is the Long Island Mozart Festival Chamber Orchestra.
Otherwise known as the Lymph Chamber Orchestra.
That's the email version.
The email version, yes. I didn't say limp, I said lymph. Yes.
Now a moment of silence for your brain.
That's right. Here on Noise Punk and Schooner. And that's your brain on drugs.
David,
anyway.
We have been enjoying your music, and we would like to enjoy one more piece. And you said you have one more piece. Now you will give it to us.
Okay.
This is the latter movement, actually, listening. Of the same piece. Go ahead.
Right.
Yes. Which, talk about this last movement.
What is it called?
Earth Passion.
Right. Well, this work, Concerto Green, was a piece that I wanted to associate with the, you know, environment, at least to sort of a hook to allow audiences to kind of get in to the form of the piece. And all of the aspects of nature that are referred to here, of course, are the things you find, you know, water and trees and earth and air and whatnot. The one element in the piece which is not associated specifically with the earth is the human element, which is passion, which is the one thing which I think is the most missing in our current world. Mm-hmm. So... I decided to construct the last movement to include a certain amount of earthiness and some passion as well.
All right. Yeah, that's
Charles says, has passion.
Oh, yeah, but not from Eugene.
Foiled again.
Right. Music, this is the latter movement of the Concerto Green by our guest David Winkler here on Noise Punk and Dust Crooner.
Thank you.
Oh, that felt like an F dominant, but it doesn't resolve to B flat, and that makes it even that much more interesting. Music of David Winkler here on Noise
Punk. Analyzed by Charles Coleman.
that was the last movement of the Concerto Green, written by our guest, David Winkler. We've been hearing music from that, as well as a few excerpts from... shut up, Gene. We've been hearing, as well as a couple of excerpts from various pieces that came out on the Naxos record label that came out... what are you doing, Gene?
I'm trying to bother you.
Throwing him off.
We also heard a couple of excerpts from David Winkler's music that is featured on the Naxos record label, but we don't want to play you everything because we think it's worth your umpteen dollars to buy it.
Yeah, go
darn
and
it.
Buy it. First of all, you can go to DavidWinkler.com. Is that your website?
DavidWinklerNYC.org.
DavidWinklerNYC.org.
Right.
You know what I just said.
Right. Right.
And I'm sure you could. There's links to probably buy your CD from.
There is, as a matter of fact, it's on the homepage.
Go to the homepage.
Yeah, I'm sure iTunes has it, among any other. And of course, go to your local record store, which yes, still exists if you're in New York.
There's no more. Like,
yes, you're at J&R Music World downtown, man. Doing
they're closed?
No, they're not.
Are you sure?
I'm positive. I've went there.
J&R.
You're Virgin closed.
Oh, Virgin.
But I spoke with I was there the other day, and the guy said that it's a renaissance there. People like to have something in their hand when they buy it. What are you doing, team? Will you shut up? Enough already. David, thank you for coming on our show. Talk to us about what you've got coming up in the near future.
Well, near future is the word for it. At the end of this month, which is September, I will be in... Thank you. I will be in Kiev and Lvov for the premier performances of my new double concerto for cello, piano soloists with orchestra, with two really great soloists. The pianist is Vladimir Vinitsky and the cellist is Natalia Koma. And the orchestra is the National Symphony Orchestra of Ukraine. And should be really exciting. There are not too many works for this combination. I didn't have any model, so to speak, to work from. So it was an exciting process, and they're great to work with. Then on October the 3rd, I have a concerto.
2009.
Also, yeah, same year, right. I have a concerto for two violins and string orchestra that will be premiered at the Long Island Mozart Festival on October the 3rd. And the next... big premiere is on January the 10th.
Of 2010.
2010, yes. From 2009 to 2010. Very good.
Yes.
The New York Philharmonic Ensembles is premiering my new piano quartet on their chamber music series at Merkin Hall. Great. And the violinist we just heard in Concerto Green, Dmitry Berlinsky, I have written, am writing a new concerto for him that will be done in February in East Lansing. For violin, percussion, and chamber orchestra, and it's called The Winds of Time, and he's a great artist, and I look forward to working with him as well.
And I believe you got a Symphony No. 3 premiere coming out.
Symphony No. 3 is on the docket, should be premiered by the Alabama Symphony. The exact date has not been set. It was written several years ago and involves chorus and baritone and soprano soloists in texts of Maya Angelou as well as Langston Hughes.
Ah.
It was commissioned by Alabama Symphony to celebrate the spirit of America, actually. And it was a great pleasure working with these wonderful, both contemporary and also previous generation poets. And so I'm looking forward to that eventual premiere. Yes.
Indeed. Well, that was
great.
Well, David, David, thank you so much for coming on our show.
You guys are absolutely fantastic, and totally, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, here's your cash, by the way, for saying that.
Here's my house.
I thought I had to give it to you.
Is that the theme music? And until next time, noise to you.
Noise punk and the schooner. Noise punk. And the schooner. Noise punk and the schooner. Noise punk.